Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 180 it is, so let's get cracking. Or crackling, which was the atmosphere in late 1850 as Xhosaland was seized by the exploits of Prophet Mlanjeni. His combined worldviews, his messianic emergence, shook the land as far away as Cape Town. As a sickly young man from near King Williamstown, he had disappeared to work in the Cape Colony and returned, claiming to have been living under the sea. Not quite SpongeBob, because unlike that lovable kid's character, Mlanjeni said it was during his stint underwater that God spoke to him. You'll remember how I explained that Mlanjeni took to sitting in pools in nearby rivers and streams, the water lapping against his face as he sat deep in thought. At first, he seemed to be in sync with the missionaries and Governor Harry Smith, saying the Amaxhosa should abandon witchcraft and avoid raiding settler cattle and so on. However, his message morphed, and very soon he was exhorting his numerous adherents to stop burning the wood of gum trees, an invasive species. He believed the exotic tree symbolized white influence. Word spread, and some began saying that Mlanjeni had miraculous powers. He could light his pipe merely from the sun. He wore his face on one cheek so he could spot witches and paralyze them. When the missionaries heard that he was also saying that he could heal the sick, give sight to the blind, and make the mute speak and the lame walk, they became unnerved. Mlanjeni refused to accept gifts. He was unbribable, and the chiefs and commoners streamed to his home. Then the British tried to arrest him, and he disappeared, thus growing ever more powerful in the eyes of his adherents. Look, they said, God is protecting the prophet from the invaders. Like Mlele, the war doctor of 1819, Mlanjeni functioned as a war doctor himself, ordering his followers to obey his commands to the word, and then the whites would be driven into the sea. The Amaxhosa could then seize all their possessions, particularly their cattle. In a further ominous sign, and something that would be catastrophic for the Xhosa in 1856, when the cattle killings began, Mlanjeni said all light-coloured cows should be killed, as they were like the Europeans. Using geranium sticks, as I explained, was his defence tactic against the English guns. Their bullets, he said, would turn to water. These sticks would be worn around the warriors' necks and be chewed, and the liquid spat at the enemy, who'd become confused and wander around. Those Xhosa who died in battle, said the prophet, were weak because they'd continued to practice witchcraft. However, those who followed his way would live. Powerful stuff, this millenarianism. It pops up like an ecclesiastical boil and poisons the minds of pretty normal people. Suddenly, they began treating a fellow human being like the reincarnation of God, come to save them. It is still with us in modern politics, this simplification. So, by December 1850, the settlers had moved into fortified towns, the Boers and some British farmers lagered together, all awaiting the coming storm. As the Amaxhosa resistance gained momentum, Mlanjeni ordered his people to hold a huge sacrifice to the ancestors and kill all their dun and cream-coloured cattle. After initially avoiding the prophet, Nika Chief Sandile of the Rarabi became an ardent supporter of this same prophet, and he prepared his warriors for war. We need to focus on these religious matters, so a quick return to the men in black. The missionaries were now in a spot. Robert Niven of the United Presbyterian Church was holding forth in Kaiskamahoek. His wife had died a week out of Cape Town when he sailed with her to South Africa in 1836, and he loved her so much he had her body placed in a large solid coffin, which was then raised to the main top, the top of the large mast on the ship, where she swung for a week until the day after they landed in Cape Town. Then she was buried. However, Niven remarried soon afterwards, which was the way back then. And as a right-minded Scot, he was sympathetic to the Amaxhosa. Below his mission, called Uniondale, below Fort Cox, was Burns Hill Mission Station, where another Scot, Alexander MacDermid, had built the station in 1830. The War of the Axe had shocked him to his core, and he had died before it ended. Burns Hill, as I've explained, was about 2 kilometres from Sandile's great place and close to the hallowed grave of his father, Nika. Assistant Commissioner Charles Brownlee was living in Fort Cox and had been appointed as the new chief over the entire Ngqika people by Harry Smith. Simmering anger, boiling energies, blunt decisions. Down the road was the historic Tumi Mission Station founded by William Chalmers, who died, but his wife and daughter remained there even after a new missionary, John Forbes Cumming of the Free Church of Scotland, was assigned the job. Further down the road was a man who you could say was taking his position as missionary into the missionary position. George Brown lived on the plains below the Amatola Mountains, not far from the Tumi Valley, arriving in early 1849. At first, people noted how he had a kind and manly appearance, but very soon, however, the manly appearance took on a reverential lust, a scandalous man, as you'll hear. Brown did not like his job, nor the Tumi area, but he did like Amakhosa women. He regarded their ways as uninhibited, and so took up his office with an energy that led to an investigation. This was launched in May 1850, when an assembly of Scots missionaries at Tumi Station called him to appear before them. The charge was, speaking too freely with native females. And by speaking, the assembly meant philandering. But first, he seduced the young Janet Chalmers, William Chalmers' daughter, and John Forbes Cumming hated him so much for this act that the two men spoke only through letters. Brown was forced to marry Janet Chalmers in August 1850, 5 months pregnant. This was an outrage, a scandal, and word reached the Right Reverend Henry Renton all the way back in Scotland. Brown's station was at Iqibire, a lonely and dusty end of the Amatolas, 40 kilometres from other mission stations or English towns of any sort. It had very little water. It was called a wasteland by Brown. Even the Amakhosa found it tough. Mbalu chief Stokwe ruled his people here. Stokwe called Brown the bull, an accurate description, according to the Amakhosa people. The women converted to Christianity at Iqibire appeared to lose their virginity at the same time. All his cleaners, for example, were painting their faces red, a sign of what the Amakhosa believe is the loss of purity. Brown was suspended for unclean conduct, a euphemism for what was likely to be physical assault and perhaps rape. When his wife, Janet, went into labour in November, Cumming cried into his journal and wrote, Janet Brown has been prematurely delivered of a male child, married August 6, 1850, a mere 3 months earlier. The seduction of a daughter of a founding father of the mission station and his philandering and rape led to a court martial. The reason I've gone into this in detail is that what was going on was the English community here and the authorities were involved in an introverted affair at the very moment that the Amakhosa were preparing for war. Up the road in the town of Addis, the commissioner, Henry Calderwood, continued his lashing of the coloured and Amakhosa transgressors, and Charles Lennox Stretch wrote, The cat o' nine tails at Alice, in the hands of Mr. Calderwood, has failed to reduce the natives to submission. It was doing the opposite. Calderwood was fully aware of how much the people who lived nearby hated him. He had barred his doors and windows and was being protected by two policemen 24 hours a day. On December 4th, Cumming was told by local chiefs that the missionaries would be killed in the coming war because of what Calderwood had done to the Amakhosa. Harry Smith had travelled to the frontier, and Sandile's mother, Sutu, who was Ngqika's widow, went to the Tumi Mission Station on the 9th of December to speak with the governor. She asked why the English wanted another war. Smith said that the chiefs were not paying fines, and she responded, You have taken away all my power. You have taken away the power of the chiefs, and then you find fault with us for not keeping the people in order. While many local councillors wanted a war with the British, others were not so sure. Sandile's most influential councillors warned him that Imlanjeni was leading the Amakhosa down a rocky path, while the colonials were demonizing Sandile as the arch-villain of the peace. Grahamstown Journal editor Robert Godlinton had recently called for him to be publicly hanged. Smith wasn't going to summarily execute anyone, but he embarked on a military adventure upon his return to King Williamstown, calling up all male colonists to enroll in militias. Smith deployed his troops, breaking them into three columns. Two were sent to guard the passes into the Amatola Mountains. George McKinnon was in command of the largest of these, 570 men under 7 officers all marched off to Fort Cox. Lieutenant Colonel William Eyre led 389 men and 4 officers to a pass north of King Williamstown, a pass called Kabusi Neck. A third column of 457 men and 7 officers were under the command of Henry Somerset. They were sent to Fort Hare. Smith had about 500 frontier men, members of this new militia, who were distributed around all the forts as well. A day after ordering their mobilization on the 16th of December, Smith posted a reward of £500 for the capture alive of Sandile. His brother, Anta, was worth £200. The Cape governor was on a roll, so he rode to Fort Cox, and Charles Brownlee was ordered to call another meeting of Ngqika chiefs set for the 19th of December 1850. More than 3,000 senior councillors pitched up, including Makoma, but of course Sandile and Anta were MIA. All the missionaries were there except Brown, who'd been sent away. Smith was always a blunt creature, and he offended the missionaries first, with Cummings saying, "His rude manners left no favourable impression upon our minds." Smith regarded the missionaries as limp-wristed lovers of the Amakosa, to be scoffed at, dangerous humanitarians. It was discipline the Amakosa needed. They had to be punished. Standing on the veranda of Brownlee's house near the mission station, the Cape governor proceeded to continue his rude manners and definitely left no favourable impression upon the 3,000 Amakosa gathered beneath. "I must have Sandile and Anta," he began. "I will spare their lives." But it was up to the Ngqika people to hand over their own chief. Smith couldn't send redcoats because Mlanjeni had already gained power by his ability to avoid them. One councillor stood up and asked the governor, logically, if he had no desire for war, and he had no desire to hunt Sandile with the redcoats, why were there so many of these redcoats around the Amatolas? Smith was irritated, flustered even. He said that Great Britain was the most powerful country on earth, and that Queen Victoria could send many big ships filled with troops to the Buffalo River mouth at East London. "But," asked one chief, "would the Great Queen's ships be able to sail up into the Amatola Mountains?" It was to the assembled Xhosa's credit that they all remained poker-faced at that comment. The councillors told Smith there was not enough evidence to prove that Sandile had been a bad chief, and this seemed to touch a nerve. This unctuous man, this brittle militarist, exploded, pouring out, as Cummings reported, all manner of vituperative epithets upon Sandile's name. Smith turned his ire on Makoma, the man he had humiliated in Port Elizabeth by placing a boot on his neck, and now said straight to the respected chief that he was a drunken beast. By now, the Amakosa leadership knew that they were going to have to fight this little man and his redcoats. The governor could not hunt Sandile down, and had admitted as much to Godlinton, saying it would be like selecting a drop of fresh water from the sea. A frustrated governor turned the redcoats out as a show of force, but he was aware that the nerves of all were shredded. During a discussion with the Grahamstown Journal editor, he'd said, "My position is one requiring great caution, discretion. A false move might involve disaster." Christmas Eve was the date selected by Harry Smith as the day his intimidatory force, as Noel Mustett called it, should march up the Bomber Pass into the Amatola Mountains. It was exactly 16 years to the day of the outbreak of the Frontier War of 1834. False information was flowing. Smith had heard that Sandile and Anta were nearby, up in the mountain. McKinnon was told to move out that night with a large force, detachments of the 73rd Highland Regiment, 6th Regiment known as the Warwickshires, a rifle brigade, the Cape Mounted Rifles, and an Amakosa police unit. 500 infantry and 100 cavalry would head up the Bomber Pass to Niven's mission at Kaiskama Hook, then turn and wind back down the slopes using an alternative route to be kept secret, returning to Fort Cox in 3 days. British thought that this would flush out Sandile and Anta, and Smith believed he had the cunning to beat the two Amakosa chiefs. He'd split his force, sending a patrol under Lieutenant Colonel William Eyre of the 73rd Regiment to the eastern side of the mountains, the opposite side of the larger force. What Smith didn't seem to realize was that he wasn't facing only Sandile and Anta's warriors. He was about to experience Makoma's tactics once more, the man who he'd insulted in public. The man he'd called a drunken beast. By now, Macoma was around 50 years old. Smith was 63, and Macoma had had enough of Smith. The Amakosa, don't forget, a slight, an insult. The resentment had built up and built up, and now opportunity for revenge presented itself. It was true that Macoma had taken to the bottle. However, he was not a useless drunk. He was fully in control of the Amanika warriors. As with all really great commanders, Macoma did not like war, but when called upon to rise up, he did so with aplomb, and Smith had forgotten how well Macoma had fought in the War of the Axe. Remember, it was this chief who changed Khoza tactics, focusing on the British logistics, their weak point. What would he dream up this time? Let's see. December in South Africa is hot, and the sky begins to lighten at around 4 a.m., and the troops needed to make it into the pass before the Khoza spies realized what was going on. At least, that was the theory. In practice, the spies had already passed on information to Macoma. A large British force was on the move towards the Kaiskamma River. They weren't slowed down by wagons this time, using mules and pack horses to transport their material. Leading this doomed column were the black police, all Amakosa, the most dangerous position in any invading column. Most were Amanika. All had fought against the British a mere 3 years earlier. Behind them rode the Cape Mounted Rifles, the Khoi Khoi troop, crack shots, expert horsemen, led by 7 white officers. The senior was Major John Jarvis Bissett. Clumping along behind these mobile men was the 6th Regiment, led by Captain J.E. Robertson, 236 soldiers in all, a powerful column, and behind the 6th was a company of over 100 men of the 73rd Regiment, and another company of 100 from the Rifle Brigade. Behind these soldiers trundled the pack horses, carrying ammunition, food, medical supplies, tents, baggage. A small rear guard was posted to keep an eye on the all-important goods. There they were, most of this army out of place in Africa, parading in their red coats up a mountain that meant nothing to the cursing foot soldiers, an alien place, thick with the vegetation that appeared to be part of the enemy, into a rough path where single file was the only way to head on up the slopes. Their muskets were kept unloaded in case of a misfire. Before leaving on Christmas Eve, Harry Smith had ensured the cooks prepared a Christmas dinner to be sent along with the column. When they bivouacked the next day, they could eat a splendid picnic meal on the cliffs of the Amatolas. What was clear to the officers was how the slopes appeared out of the dawn light on Christmas Day, but a great deal was unclear. What exactly were they doing here? To McKinnon and Smith, it was a demonstration of power to the Amakosa, but for the troops, they really believed they were going to capture Sandile and Anta. This was no mere manoeuvre, it was battle. Lieutenant Armitage of the 6th Regiment said so. Bissett, the Cape Mounted Rifles officer, concurred. The column wound its way into the impressive Kaiskamma River Gorge and crisscrossed the river 3 times. Each time the thickets grew closer and the cliffs more vast, hemming them in, and by 7 a.m. they stopped on the banks of the river for 2 hours. Breakfast in the dappled sunshine. Happy Christmas. The men chatted about a strange thing they'd seen en route. They passed by freshly piled stones, which the experienced troops said was a blessing. Passers-by always added to the pile. It was a Amakosa custom. But something was out of place this time. A large boulder appeared to be balanced at the very top of this cairn of small stones. The Cape Mounted Rifles men and the Amakosa police knew this was Imlanjeni's doing, invoking an evil omen for the army heading into the dark reaches of the Amatolas. Something else had worried the experienced soldiers. Usually, when a large British column travelled into the Amatolas and stopped, Khoza women would appear and sell the soldiers milk and vegetables and corn. However, on Christmas morning of 1850, only one woman appeared, and many amongst the column thought it more than odd. She was spying. Moments later, Bissett, who was celebrating his own birthday, stopped celebrating because he noticed hundreds of Amakosa men on the hills through his binoculars. It was unclear if they were armed, at least at first. He rode to McKinnon and warned him of their presence and flagged that if the British continued, they'd be forced into an even longer single file into Boma Pass itself. This pass was dotted with huge boulders that had fallen from these unstable heights, and warriors would find it easy to chop up an English soldier from behind these obstacles. Mackinnon, for some reason, dismissed Bissett's warning, saying that Xhosa were not hostile, and even if they were, they would be too afraid to fight this massive column. He had dismissed the story about Imlanjeni's bullets to water incantations to his Amaxhosa warriors, who now feared nothing at all. Some of the British troops continued swimming in the river. It was midsummer, after all, Christmas Day. Let them have some fun. Bissett, however, was filled with dread. Boma Pass awaited. Its torturous, winding path, thick vegetation, boulders in the path, and Amaxhosa warriors. If the British attacked here, he feared chaos would ensue. Maxhosa and Imlanjeni were banking on it. Just to add a final touch of outlandishness, the soldiers continued into the pass with unloaded weapons. Bissett was riding at the front with the Cape Mounted Rifles and the Amaxhosa police. They entered the tunnels of bush, the English officer deadpan, but his heart pounding. On the left was a sheer cliff, and to the right, the Keiskamma River flowed strongly, too fast to be forded. The column was heading into the worst possible place anywhere on this frontier as they crawled up the steep slope. The line began to stretch out. It thinned. The distance between the front and rear increased to 2 kilometres. Mackinnon joined Bissett at the front, and as they exited this terrifying pass, many men of the column had yet to enter at the bottom. Lieutenant Armitage of the 6th Regiment was among the rear guard, and he kept his binoculars focused on the cliffs, and what he saw shocked him. Hundreds of warriors appeared to be looking over the pass from the cliff tops, and he swore later that one of those looked like Sandile. Now, there was no doubt all were armed, and there was no way of telling Mackinnon what was going on. The front could not communicate with the rear, but the Amaxhosa could see everyone. They began shooting at the British, who at first thought it was their own men shooting at Buck. As the musket balls whizzed over their heads, the officers ordered the men into cover behind the trees and the rocks. Meanwhile, Mackinnon, Bissett and the Cape Mounted Rifles and Amaxhosa police at the top of the pass stopped when they heard the sounds of firing. A minute passed and they heard the volley that meant the British soldiers had fired their brown besses back. The gap in response, they estimated, was about the time it took the infantry to get the musket balls from their pouches into the barrels and fire the return shots. Unable to hear each other except perhaps a really loud bugle call, the British now relied on a kind of broken telephone word of mouth. Behind Mackinnon in the depths of the pass, it was indeed chaos. Some soldiers were told to wait, others to attack. Some were firing, others holding their fire. An officer shouted charge. But what did this mean? A distant bugle call sounded the call to advance, and then at the double. What exactly were they to advance at? Try and clamber up the cliffs to fight the Amaxhosa, or advance up the trail? The tactical move here of an army in this situation is standardized. If trapped, don't remain strung out, tighten formation, turn, face the attackers, fight. Because the British soldiers were numerous and very well armed, they probably would have succeeded in chasing off the warriors, particularly because the warriors were now standing in full view, having been convinced by Prophet Imlanjeni they were impervious to the English musket balls. A disaster was in the making for this column. What happened next is for episode 181. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. We'll have a little update about the series, and you can email me from there too. Until next, Salagatli.